In the late afternoon, the descendants of the cannibal's victim lined up warily, side by side, outside the church in the island's village square. Flowers and balloons decorated the square, and three old women stood and moaned to music on the back of a truck. The balloons tossed and twisted in gusts from the ocean, and palms lashed back and forth. Facing each of the descendants, staring deeply into their eyes, stood a descendant of someone who'd eaten their ancestor. Now a helicopter rose above the headland and clattered over the square, showering the crowd with sand and setting the village dogs cringing and barking before disappearing into the hinterland. A loudspeaker crackled, the music and keening stopped, and a deep male voice made an announcement in pidgin that the visitors didn't understand. In the silence that followed, they became aware of the surf breaking against the outer reef, the wind rattling the palms, and the low sun rays filtering across the square. To identify their unique status, the victims' successors and their partners had been given special island clothes to wear. Outsized red and green flowered shirts and dresses, all of the same material made by the village women, obviously to local measurements, for they hung loosely on the visitors and flapped in the breeze. The cannibals' male heirs, meanwhile, wore only woven palm loincloths, and their heads and their bodies were painted to resemble skeletons. Drumming started up suddenly in the background, and the skeleton men began panting in unison and stamping their feet to the beat. The skull mouth of the cannibal descendant in front of Damien Horn was red from chewing betel nut, and the man loomed so close that Damien felt the pungent heat of his breath on his face. Averting his head from the man's heavy exhalations, Damien attempted a calming smile and sympathetic wink at Lisa, his flustered wife, who was simultaneously trying to subdue her billowing dress while avoiding the panting breath of an even larger skeleton man. Damien's wink was intended to remind Lisa of their honoured status here on this remote atoll in the Central Pacific, where the cultures of Polynesia, Melanesia and Micronesia lapped over the coral reefs and flowed into each other. It was meant to convey things like, "Relax, Lees, I know this seems crazy, but let's appreciate the uniqueness of our bizarre situation, a once-in-a-lifetime experience. We're their guests, just go with it." Flecks of red juice flew from the chin of Damien's island attendant. Over the drumming, the old woman started keening again. Damien's wink hadn't calmed Lisa. An indoor-looking woman, his wife appeared too frail and urban against his tropical island decor. From the moment the reef explorer had sailed away and left them there, she'd turned pale. Her whole aspect clashed, and he hoped she wasn't about to faint. In Sydney, Damien worked in IT, and Lisa edited Bibelot, a smart interior design magazine. Their journey to the island of Akina, where Damien's great-great-grandfather, the Reverend Isaac Horn, an English Methodist missionary, had been killed and eaten in 1867, had begun 18 months before with a flurry of emails from a distant cousin, Dr. Jennifer Horn Smith, in Leeds. These were followed by a string of back-and-forth correspondence with the other Isaac Horn descendants, including Bradley Horn in San Francisco, Kevin Horn in Auckland, Catherine Underhill in Melbourne, and Julie Truscott in Adelaide. The islanders of Akina want to hold a special 150th anniversary ceremony to make amends to the Horn descendants, declared Dr. Horn Smith's initial message. I've been asked for the family's reaction. A sensitive matter, as you can imagine. What do you think? I must say I strongly support it myself. Her academic interest in traditional Pacific Island carvings, weapons, and domestic implements had led to Jennifer, an associate professor at the Institute of Social and Cultural Anthropology at the University of Leeds, meeting George Bougainvanneau, Akina's representative in the Pacific Islands Forum, when he accompanied a collection of Kauinan artefacts to the Pacifica exhibition at the British Museum 18 months before. Over drinks at the exhibition's opening party, an animated Jennifer soon let George Bougainvanneau know that her cultural appreciation of the island of Akina extended beyond battle clubs, carver bowls and penis gourds. After two wines, it was somehow thrilling to approach him and announce, a little hectically, "Your ancestor ate my ancestor." She thought he might frown or grin uncomfortably, but George Bougainvanneau, a suave man in his mid-50s, with the height and bulk of a former international rugby front rower for Fiji, replied, "Yes, you're right. I want to talk to you about it." Over dinner and more drinks afterwards, they discussed Akina in some depth, and especially their rarest of ancestral links, the manner and immediate aftermath of Isaac Horn's death. As she solemnly told George Bougainvanneau, The events of that day on Akina are the reason I do what I do. I understand, he said, his manner as grave as hers, and presently she found herself studying his mouth, considering the square white teeth, how similar each big tooth was to the one next to it, and the vigorous movement of his jaws as he bit into his beef Wellington. A muscle twitched below his ear as he chewed. When he downed his Shiraz, his neck swelled as he swallowed. How long are you in England? She asked. Another week, as it turned out. She imagined his teeth biting into her living flesh. Let me show you around, she said.